Welcome to Nattering with the Knights, Nord Anglia International School Hong Kong's PE department, talking about sport, physical activity, health, and a host of other topics.
This week I am joined by Sebastian Bates, the founder and head instructor of the Warrior Academy. The Warrior Academy is a martial arts academy based both in the UK and in Dubai, but it also has a strong online following that is increasing all the time. Sebastian has over 20 years experience in six disciplines of martial arts, and he competed nationally and internationally from amateur to professional level in Europe and Asia in several martial arts. He has become the British champion in two styles of Taekwondo competition amongst other titles, and he also has achieved a second Dan in Taekwondo. After training in Asia for over 1.5 years, Sebastian returned to England to build the martial arts organisation that is now known as the Warrior Academy. He's also a published author in the field of character development, having written The Warrior Method, which dives deep into our methodology to develop character in young people. This is a really captivating episode, guys. Sebastian is a great storyteller, so get the earphones in, get up and get active, and enjoy.
Okay, guys. Hey, welcome back to another episode of Nattering with the Knights. Today, I am joined by, Sebastian Bates, the founder and head instructor of the Warrior Academy. Now, I've done an introduction at the start of the episode, so I won't go into too much more detail, but I'm just going to pass over straight away to Sebastian. How are you today?
Yeah, very well. Thanks, Callum. Thanks for inviting me on.
Yeah, no, great to have you. I've actually listened to Sebastian in another or a couple of other podcasts. He's a host of his own or a couple of podcasts, and I've also listened to him on another business one. So definitely somebody that's going to be interesting and inspirational for our listeners today. So let's go first of all to your own experience of sport and PE as a youngster. Sebastian, what were you involved in? What got you going when you were younger?
Sport and PE when I was younger. Well, I grew up in Aldershot in the south of the UK, in a military family. So my dad was in the Paras and Commandos. And, we had a very active lifestyle outside of school. I used to watch him jump out of planes every weekend. And my time was spent climbing tanks, doing assault courses, and coming home when the street lights went on, which is something a lot of children don't do now. Well, no one does it now at the moment, do they? But certainly back then, that was a super exciting childhood. I can remember being taught when I was 5 or 6 years old to abseil off my garage and all this sort of stuff. So I think adventure and staying healthy and doing all that sort of stuff was very much the norm when I grew up. In school, my first school was an army school. It was about 30 students in the class. There wasn't a lot of discipline in the class. I don't really recall too much in primary school of PE. But later on, when we moved out of the area, I started martial arts when I was about 7 or 8. And that's when I really kind of found something I was passionate about.
Okay, cool. That sounds ace, the adventure part. I mean, I'm big into that myself, but I didn't quite probably have that exposure as a young man like you. So then, as you kind of moved through adolescence and into young adulthood, you sort of said you started to move into martial arts. What was then the journey from then on?
Yeah, so initially, I think we moved out of Aldershot into Wiltshire, and my parents were keen for me to start the sport. Both my older sister was heavily into gymnastics. My youngest sister was in the GB team, training for the Olympics. Both of them became gymnastics coaches. My brother was heavily into football, so was I when I was younger. But for me, I started martial arts essentially to build confidence, I think. And it seemed like a fun thing to do. My parents certainly wanted me to do it to build confidence. And I think later on, about 2 or 3 years into martial arts training, I was going through this really tough bullying at school, both in primary and then a little bit in secondary. And having the kind of support and the community through martial arts made such a big impact on my life and really created a kind of turning point, which set me up for a very, very different route, I think. Taught me so many important skills, developed my character, gave me a moral compass. I think as I kind of look back and join the dots up, it's probably why, I started the Warrior Academy, to help other children who were going through things that I was going through. And I had martial arts there as that support.
And do you think, so just to zoom in a little bit on the bullying aspect, do you think that some of the reason was that as a military family, you because you were maybe moving around a little bit more. Did you feel that that was maybe one of the aspects for being a target for something like bullying?
Yeah, totally. So, I mean, I've worked with about 10,000 families around the world. We've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of parents whose children have gone through bullying. And the importance of that is we're looking at data, right? So a lot of people, when they're helping students or young people with bullying, they're not necessarily looking at the data. They're looking at their own thoughts and ideas. But we're combining that with what people are actually saying they're going through. And what we found is there's three massive transitions that people would like to go through: changing schools, adolescence, and bullying. And they typically happen within a 1 to 3 year period. So most of those three things happen, between the age of 9 and 13, right? And it's this huge disruption of emotions, community, social, biological. Everything changes in such a short amount of time. So it's a really, really key period of time. So without a doubt, when I changed schools from the group of 30, there were 13 teachers in 1 year because the teachers kept on quitting because they hated to teach, I think, because the kids were so badly behaved. We had kids, climbing on tables. It was just like unreal. It was a great school, great community, but this class was out of hand. When I kind of look back, probably the fact that, the mums or dads who were in the army were going away for 6 months at a time, maybe difficult situations at home, a lot of kids from disadvantaged backgrounds, you ramming a lot of people into one room, and this high turnover of teachers meant that their problems never really got solved. When I left from there to Wiltshire, my parents realized I was behind quite heavily academically. I was about 2 years behind, and they wanted me to go to a private school. We found this private school where there was only about sort of 8 to 10 kids in the class, but they were from a completely different background to me, right? I grew up in this environment which was just the polar opposite of these kids. So I was the new kid in the class, and they had already formed, a tight social circle, and I was obviously quite different to them. So that change made it, created the perfect environment to be bullied. And I think because it was such an old school environment from a teaching perspective, we're talking, this place is like out of Harry Potter or something, right? It's probably exactly what I needed from an academic point of view, but there was so much pressure on old school discipline. You do something wrong, you're outside the headmaster's office with your hands behind your back for 30 minutes, just facing the wall, this sort of stuff, right? And it was run by a headmistress and headmaster who were in their late 80s. I think when he finished, he was 90 something. So, they were pretty old. Let's just say that, right? But they had old school methods, and I think that actually made the bullying worse, because if you were behind academically, there wasn't their level of support. It was more, you should be doing this, therefore you're doing this wrong. Do you know what I mean? There wasn't that nurturing aspect to ease that transition. So it was a very much like a bang, new place. No doubt, exactly as you said, that change, that moving schools, created that environment for bullying to occur.
Okay, so we might come back to that, actually, because obviously I know that's one of your big motivations as well for the Warrior Academy. And then just to kind of go back to your sporting angle of things, so I noticed you've had some success as a martial arts in a competitive environment. Can you just talk through some of those experiences? Roll back the years?
Yeah, absolutely. So I spent sort of the last 25 to 28 years studying 6 different martial arts around the world, competing from amateur to professional level. Started off with Taekwondo, which is a semi-contact sport in the UK, so ITF Taekwondo. And I got up to black belt within the first sort of 6-7 years. I think when I was about 13, I was a black belt there. For me, sparring, pads on, going to competitions was the best bit about Taekwondo. It was taking the skills we had learned in the dojo and applying them in a sporting, competitive environment. I come from a super competitive family, so that was a great thing to feel and be a part of for me. Before I was a teenager, I had won multiple English championships, West of England championships, British championships. And then when I was about 13, 14, I started moving into boxing and kickboxing. The contact got a little bit heavier, and I started to become obsessed with Thai boxing. Thai boxing is obviously full contact. We're not talking, light Taekwondo contact. We're talking elbows, knees, no head guards. It's pretty much the most brutal martial art out there. And from the age of 16, to about 18. I was basically living like a Thai boxer. So I got in contact with a Thai boxing camp, and I asked them to send me a schedule of what they do each day, how they live, what they eat. And from the age of 16, I just changed everything in my life to mimic that. So, you know, I'd be the only one coming into school with a lunchbox with like boiled chicken and raw broccoli. And, you know, it was ridiculous for a young 15, 16 year old. But it was discipline of mind, and I was very focused on what I wanted to do, and martial arts brought that out of me. Then I kind of had a couple of years away from martial arts. I was focused more on boxing, but I joined the Royal Marines Reserve. So, you know, watching my dad in the army growing up and watching him as a commander, as a paras, it always interested me. And so I wanted to see if it was what I wanted to do. So when I was 16 and a half, I signed up for the Royal Marines Reserves. And essentially when I was 17, they allowed me in. You had to be 17 to join. So every Wednesday, I was training there in Bristol with them. And then every other week, we would do three-day training in Dartmoor. So it was quite an intense experience because, you know, I was just turned 17, doing my A-levels or just about to. And in my freeze, I was, you know, running with boots on, with webbing around, you know, around the town and coming back while everyone else was just chilling out. So attracting discipline and routine into my life, mixture of growing up in the army and martial arts. And so I think after that, you know, I spent all this time in the Royal Army Reserves. From a martial arts point of view, there was a lot of focus on unarmed combat, which was really exciting to see how the military used self-defense. And all my friends were in their 30s, so I was 17. So from 17 to 19, 18, I grew up very, very quickly. You know, in a short space of time, just being around people who are over a decade older than me in that environment, I grew up very, very quickly. And so I found myself, you know, in a position where I felt in some ways more mature than a lot of my friends at school. The experiences I had were very, very different to them. So when I was 18, I then left for the UK and I moved to Denmark and I became a chef in Denmark. And I worked as a chef in Denmark for about 6 months, 6 to 8 months, while I was applying to go to university there. So one of the reasons I wanted to study abroad in Denmark is because, I was also quite interested and fascinated by architecture. And that was one of the things I wanted to study. And so I applied to go to Denmark to do that. Also because university was free for anyone in the EU. Back then, sensitive subjects, we won't go into it too much. But the idea of leaving the UK, traveling, experiencing another country and living abroad was really exciting. So again, kind of having that independence from a young age, led me to kind of working and living and studying abroad. I did that for about a year and a half, studying in Denmark. And then I realized, you know what, when I was about 18 and a half, 19 and a bit, I realized that it wasn't for me. It was a completely different environment to my friends who were studying in the UK. So, you know, it was difficult in terms of financially. Yes, university was free, but there were no loans for anything. So, you know, I was studying from 7 a.m. because it was a tough course until about 6 p.m. every single day. And then because I couldn't speak the language until the very end, I was washing dishes in a steakhouse every single night from about 8 p.m. to 2 a.m. And then I'd wake up in the morning, my shoes would still be wet and I'd be going to uni. So, you know, it was tough. It wasn't the uni experience that a lot of British people love, right? It was the complete opposite. And I remember speaking to my university professor and just saying, "Look, where will I be in 20, 30 years if I absolutely smash this?" And from her point of view, she wanted to inspire me. She gave me an example. And just by having an example of saying, "This is the best you can do," it put me off completely. So it kind of backfired and I left on the spot. That evening, I bought a one-way flight to India and just started traveling around India at the age of sort of 19 and a half. So it was quite a radical shift. Traveled for a long time in India and then Southeast Asia, ended up on Thai boxing camps. Fell in love with Thai boxing. I'd always wanted to do it. Like I mentioned, when I was younger, 15, 16, living like a Thai boxer. And then I was able to do it, right? So I was out there and I was training in the north of Thailand for several months, training in the south, sort of 6 to 8 hours a day. We'd go on long, you know, 6 to 8 mile runs up the mountains in the morning. And then we'd come back and do 2 hours of pad work and bag work and then sparring in the afternoon, clinching and fitness training, all this sort of stuff. It was amazing. you know, you're training your body to just withstand so much. And it was, you know, it completely transformed me, I think, going through something like that. And so, I fell in love with it. I realized, look, I want to go back to the UK. Obviously, you know, I can't live this lifestyle forever. And I did a personal training course in the UK. I wanted to do something physical. I didn't want to be stuck in an office like I am today. Only joking. I didn't want to be stuck in an office all the time, every day, right? I wanted to be doing something more physical with my life, with my in my day to day. I love being physical, love being active, and being a PT. I also kind of wanted to run my own business, and so I had that aspect a little bit by being a PT. Did a 6-week PT course. I'd done A-level at A-level PE, so I was already heavily into it. All the books I'd been reading behind the scenes were always about fitness, that sort of stuff, so it all fascinated me. And my first gig when I finished the PT course was a Thai boxing club. There was a inner city, I say inner city, it was Bath, in a kind of very run-down gym in the centre of Bath. And it was this most testosterone-fueled gym you've ever seen. People had signed up to the Thai boxing class to beat other people up, I think, or just because they wanted to let out all this testosterone. It was pretty ridiculous, but it was great fun. There was amazing camaraderie, all that sort of stuff. And my whole angle was more bringing out these important values in the people in the group, right? Kind of taking that energy and passion they had and directing it into something super positive and constructive. And this is where the Warrior Academy began. A lot of people think that it started with a kids club. It started with an adults club. The reason the Warrior Academy moved into a kids club is because I was working with so many teenagers in the group. A lot of teenagers, they were heavily disadvantaged. They were sometimes sleeping rough on the streets. Everything that could possibly go wrong, drugs, alcohol, abuse, you know, you name it. They were coming in, beating up, all these different issues that were out of their control. It was circumstantial. It's kind of the context of their lives. But what I taught them is that they had more control over the outcome of their life than they realized. And, you know, redirecting their moral compass and ultimately developing their character. And, you know, they would come in and they would be very, very different. You know, they'd be sleeping rough, and then they'd be waiting outside the gym in the morning because they wanted to be there. Right. And, you know, we took this group of about 7 or 8 teens, and we took them to the national championships. You know, we developed about 15 national champions that year, in their first year, from the training. And I suddenly started to think, well, what if we could make this impact in their lives earlier on? What if we could capture them at like 5 or 6 years old and start to plant these seeds, start to develop these important values, start to really work on the development of their character? You know, what would the compounding effect of those positive decisions look like in their life, right? You imagine their life being like this, and now we're trying to fix certain aspects so they can grow. What if we just capitalize on a series of good decisions, good morals from a young age? And so I really wanted to work with younger people, you know, and now, you know, we launched our first Warrior Academy club in 2000 and the end of 2010, beginning of 2011, in a small village school with 100 students in it. We had about 20 students sign up. And you know, 10 years later, we've got about 2,000 students around the world in 2 continents. And it's just, you know, it's amazing to look back on, you know, that it started in this rundown gym, and now we've got students who have been with us for almost 10 years, and they're now becoming instructors in our clubs as well.
Well, okay, that's a really interesting backdrop as to how the academy started. One of my next questions was your motivation. What was the motivation? Yeah. You've touched on that already. So can we delve in a little bit more about the values and principles that underpin the academy? Now, you've obviously mentioned developing confidence quite a few times, but I know there's some more that you kind of really push to develop, and values that you develop in the academy.
Yeah, totally. So I actually wrote a book in 2018 called The Warrior Method, which basically details our 4-step methodology, which is community, inspire, challenge, lead. And so when you look at how we develop the character of a young person, you know, the first step is community, right? You've got to create a safe and supportive community for a young person to be a part of. And obviously you need to teach a child to leave their comfort zone and challenge themselves and to feel uncomfortable and grow, but they can't do that unless they're part of a supportive community. So the most important thing is community. And that's a value that's embedded into everything we do. You know, from the way that we look after the parents in our clubs, to the students, to our team, everything's about community. And so once we've immersed children into a strong community, then we need to inspire them. So inspiration, really, you're painting a picture of what someone can become. So when I look back at, the conversation I had with the university professor, right? This is what you can become. There you go. That's it. If you work your socks off for 40 years, you'll be just like me, right? The way we try and look at inspiration is it's got to be internal. They've got to see and build a picture of what they want themselves. But ultimately, whenever you are speaking to a young person, as you'll know, as a mentor, as a teacher, you're inspiring through language. So we teach our team that every time they speak to a young person is an opportunity to inspire them. And, you know, every word, it goes towards painting that picture. So inspiration is a massive point of what we do. For a lot of students, they look at the black belt. That's what they want to achieve. For parents, we explain to them that the black belt's the tip of the iceberg. But really what a parent wants is everything underneath the surface, right? It's the black belt character. A child with a black belt character is more likely to go on and live a happy and successful life as an adult. And that's what the parent wants. But for the child, that's the black belt. I want to be just like all the other, the black belts I see, which have all these amazing values, right? So community, inspire, challenge. Leaving your comfort zone and learning to leave your comfort zone, as I like to kind of see it, because it's a process rather than a one-off event, right? It's an understanding. You can't really tell a child, this is how the comfort zone works. It will get easier. They've got to live it and breathe it, and they've got to be nurtured and mentored through that. So we take our children on a kind of journey where we call it the black belt journey, but on a journey where they experience something uncomfortable, which they choose, and they seek that discomfort over the comfort. And by doing that regularly, like I mentioned about the compounding effect of these positive decisions, they start to widen their comfort zone, get far more used to being uncomfortable, not being afraid of it. You know, they don't have that level of anxiety because they haven't gone into the higher anxiety level. They're in that optimal performance zone whenever they're challenged. And, it's that regular challenge that makes the big impact, right? And I often look back into my childhood, like I mentioned, a childhood filled with adventure. That's stuck with me for life, whether it's Royal Marines from a young age, it's traveling, I got heavily into skydiving and base jumping and did about 500 skydives and wingsuit base jumps around the world and all these other things where I basically forced myself into challenges. I remember when I was younger, me and my dad, we put our mountain bikes into cardboard boxes, took them to Africa, and we cycled 500 miles across the Sahara Desert. We did the same thing around Turkey when I was about 20. So it was constantly, I think when you encourage young people to seek challenge and adventure, that's when you see these massive jumps, right? So for us, challenge is a huge part of it. The next thing is lead. So community, inspire, challenge, lead. And leadership and developing leadership skills obviously does so many amazing things for a young person. It's got this amazing ability to develop emotional intelligence, which I think it's one of the most important skills of a leader, right? This ability to understand complex social dynamics and situations. And I think if more leaders in the world had incredible emotional intelligence, they'd make better decisions. They'd inspire their teams more. They'd make a bigger impact. But it's also got this ability when you teach a young person to lead and teach what they've learned, they are re-rehearsing, relearning everything they've done. And even as instructors, as a teacher yourself, when you're teaching something, sometimes you grasp a much deeper understanding of that subject, that topic, because you're having to explain it or simplify it and then explain it. So this cycle of community, inspire, challenge, lead, which kind of goes around in a circle, it's fundamental to the growth of a child's character. And so that's what we published in the book, The Warrior Method, which is on Amazon. And it's a Kindle version as well. So that's basically our methodology. In terms of the impact we choose to make, we basically, as I mentioned, we interviewed, over 2,000 parents. We interview every single parent who joins the War Academy. And from that, we can gather huge amounts of data. So we're very much a martial arts club of the future, right? We're gathering data so that we can understand parents' problems better. And we created something called the Breakthrough Area Assessment. So when a child first joins us, and this all comes from the data, right? This all comes from the thousands and thousands of data points that we've gathered over the years. We know that parents need help with developing the three C's. So competence, conduct, and concentration. And ultimately, you know, when you bring all the three C's up to a high level, you develop what we call a black belt character. So if any parents listening to this right now, this might sound familiar, or even as a teacher, this one might sound familiar from a lot of the students you've taught. You know, if you look at the three C's, competence, conduct, concentration, a child will typically have one or two, but rarely all three, right? So they may have amazing confidence, but they lack in conduct or they lack in concentration, right? Imagine a student or a child with, you know, high energy levels, likes new social situations, likes leaving their comfort zone, likes trying new things, a bit like my daughter right now. But because of this high energy level, they're often seen as lacking concentration. They need more stimulation. So that often teachers are like, you know, you're badly behaved, you're naughty. Parents think their child's misbehaving. Really, they just need more stimulus. And then the behavior goes down. They start to believe they're naughty because they're told you're naughty. So there's this kind of slippery slope there, but they've got high confidence. On the flip side of that, you often have children with incredibly high concentration. Think more introvert, good concentration. They never do anything wrong, but actually they struggle to try new things. They don't like to be picked for this or that or entering new social groups, or they may even be too shy to put their hand up, even they know they're going to get the answer right. They don't want to be seen or heard as much. And so that has a negative impact because confidence is so important, right? Confidence is important for everything in your life. It impacts every decision you make. It impacts every interview you go to. It impacts the relationships you build or seek, you know, the friendships you have, your self-worth, your mental health. So all these important things are tied together in the three C's. So you work on all three to bring them up to a higher level. But if you go to BA or breakthrougharea.com, you can actually do the breakthrough area assessment. And it's 45 questions, they're yes, no questions, it takes 5 minutes. You get a personalized PDF report afterwards, which gives you an insight into what score your child would get in each C. Then once you know what the lowest C is, let's say you've done the assessment, you've figured out that, you know, you've got 80% in conduct, 70% in concentration, but 20% in confidence, you can then see, right, well, I need to work on the confidence level. And it's often quite interesting because parents have this perception of what their child is, of what they need to work on. And they don't see some of the red flags that we see as mentors having worked with children for so many years. So we use that not as a pass or fail, my child's high in confidence or low in confidence, and here's a score and all that stuff. We use that as what I kind of call it like a character compass, right? It gives us an insight as, you know, as mentors who focus on the development of character as to what we can work on to make the greatest impact in the shortest amount of time. So, you know, we have that insight from the very first class. And then every 3 months, we ask parents to do it again. So we can look back and say, I've just checked out your breakthrough assessment. You've gone up from 45% in confidence to 65% in confidence in the last 3 months. And I think having something measurable really, really helps parents. So that's basically okay. Our methodology and how we tie it all together.
And just as, again, slightly going off of my original kind of line. So in terms of this sort of, the young people that are signing up for your classes and for the academy, and I'll use Dubai as the example just because obviously that's where things are happening face to face just now. Do you find that young people are coming to you already with low sporting, but like generally speaking, it's my experience of people that would join a martial arts would not already be taking part in a football, a basketball, golf. They would generally be not maybe have had a great sporting experience elsewhere. Or are you finding you've got young people who are involved in team sports, are quite good, but also are prepared to come into that martial art environment as well?
We get a real mix, you know. So first of all, I think you're bang on. I think, you know, martial arts in general often encourages people to join who are, in some ways, they can be more introverted. They can have had a difficult experience, you know, not being picked for a team often, that sort of stuff. I think the reality is it's an individual sport, right? So, you know, it's self-development, but while you're part of a team setting, which is why we focus on community. So it's the way we see it is, yes, you're kind of working on your own things and developing yourself and your focus on yourself. You're also part of this wider community who all help each other. And we do a lot of team building activities, a lot of team sports. So we kind of make martial arts into a team sport. But yeah, certainly, we've got so many students who come from incredible sporting backgrounds, and they want to pursue martial arts and take it to a very high level, and they typically go on to compete nationally, and they're regularly at our competitions. And you know, they might really enjoy football, and they'll be doing both up until they're kind of 13, 14 to, you know, twice a week, three times a week or whatever. And then they're like, right, now I'm going to choose. They tend to, at that age, sort of then start to choose one over the other. But yeah, it's a big mix. But I think you're right in terms of what you said there, yeah.
Okay. So in terms of COVID, it's obviously impacted a lot of people, especially young people, with the nature of school closures. I know in Dubai, there was school closures. I know that they're currently reopened. But then in the UK, they're now currently closed again. So how's that kind of, how have you altered your provision as a business who's in the business of helping young people? What have you done to try and ensure that you're still impacting their lives in a regular basis?
Yeah, so I mean, the first thing that happened here, I was in Johannesburg with speaking with a psychologist over there to help develop our anti-bullying program. And I think I pretty much got the last flight out of Johannesburg with the lockdown happening in Dubai. And obviously, you're in Hong Kong, right? So your situation is very different to us. But for a lot of people here, they were thinking, this is never going to come from China to here. And so a lot of people in the UK were thinking, it's probably going to stop in the Middle East. It's not going to come down here. So having to run a business both in Dubai with 1,000 students, then the UK with 1,000 students, it was like having to go through COVID twice, you know? So it was quite full on. With Dubai, it was a sudden bang. Lockdown, nothing's happening. So it was quite tricky. And it was very, very difficult. But what we did as a team is I remember sitting with the team, writing our values on the whiteboard, community, inspire, challenge, lead, and going through what's the essence of the Warrior Academy? Why are we here? What's the point of the Warrior Academy? Big picture, what's the point? And we really dove into our values, and we realized that, you know, this is our purpose. This is what we want to achieve. The delivery of that was physical in-class martial arts classes. So the only thing that was actually changing from this was the delivery. So we changed from a physical class to a virtual class, right? So we had these Zoom classes, all that sort of stuff, but we also filmed the entire black belt journey. So I worked with a production house for 10 days. I was filming 14 hours a day for 10 days nonstop, with about three or four different cameras. We had some of our students coming in as well. It was pretty tiring, to be honest. But we managed to film 700 martial arts classes. I taught every class from white belt to black belt in a 10-day period. So we then chopped these up into 20-minute bite-sized classes. So every single child, you know, if you're a green belt and it's your fourth class as a green belt, that's online for you. That's in the Warrior Net, right? If you're a red belt, it's your second class, that's on Warrior Net. If you're a blue belt and it's your 12th class, that's on Warrior Net. So the beautiful thing about that is we created this asset which our students could use forever. If they ever miss a class now and they've missed the self-defense class for yellow belt, they know they can go home and catch it up before the next class. So essentially what we did is we emerged from COVID as a hybrid organization, you know, offline and virtual as well. So we had that to help support us, help support our team. And it even goes as far as to help, you know, support new instructors who are coming in and learning our syllabus and exactly how we teach. They can literally go through Warrior Net and learn the whole process. But I think one of the most important things is community, right? So it wasn't enough just to create a single, you know, an online class and then just say, look, come to the online class, that's it. For an online class to work, you've got to have accountability and you've got to have familiarity or community, right? And for a lot of people, they kind of set and forget their classes or their courses. But for us, what we did is we phoned up every single parent. So over that 3-month period, we phoned up every single parent at the Warrior Academy during lockdown just to have a 20 to 40 minute non-rush chat. And, you know, this chat was, even if they had stopped paying membership for us, whatever it was, this chat was talking about their lives, talking about their kids. We had parents crying on the phone because they were completely panicked and worried and anxious about what they should do. And, you know, parents who had lost their jobs, lost their homes, health issues, all these different things. And I think when people look back, they realize kind of who was there to kind of support them, who actually showed up. And I think that's leadership, right? Showing up when you need to. And it was a real it was a real game changer for me, because I looked at, you know, for instance, in Dubai, we had a hardcore, short, sharp lockdown for about 3 or 4 months. In the UK, we had lockdowns on and off for over a year, or almost a year coming up. It will be over a year by the time we're there. And for the UK, you know, a lot of our new students did leave because they had just signed up to something. They realized they weren't going to continue, and they stopped. For our current members who had been with us 6 to 8 years, the majority of them stayed. You know, hundreds of students stayed and paid their membership, and I realized how valuable the community was, because you know, the business was able to keep on running because people were valuing more than just the classes. It was the community. It was, you know, when we talk back on how, you know, martial arts may be an individual sport, but the community is why they're there, right? It's feeding off each other. It's that inspiration. It's something that's not tangible. It's hard to describe, but it's a feeling you get when you walk into a dojo, when you meet up with your friends, when you go to a competition. It's a sense of belonging. And I think that value has helped us massively, and help other people and help us as well during that difficult lockdown situation, both from a moral perspective and from a business perspective.
And then I assume this would probably be falling into that realm. I had a list here of saying, what are some of the biggest achievements or success stories of the academy? I would imagine that being able to make that flip and go into that virtual world so quickly and still make an impact on the level you've been able to do is one of them. But is there any other major kind of ones that spring to mind in terms of achievements and success stories of the academy so far?
Yeah, I think being voted top five in the UK for activities for children was an amazing achievement. Another amazing achievement, I would say, was I was asked to be the personal trainer of the Royal Family in our first 3 months of living in Dubai. So I was working directly with the Royal Family here in the palace here in Dubai, but also in their home in London. So I was, you know, 1 week in Dubai, 1 week in London, every single week for about 3 to 6 months. And that was an amazing achievement and an honor. I think then I kind of think back and how our team kind of held together during lockdown. That's obviously an incredible achievement. It attests to the culture of the Warrior Academy, and that was absolutely amazing. I think personally, one of the things that we're really trying to push is our scholarships. So for me, some of our partnerships with charities has been amazing. You know, we in the Warrior Academy, every single membership, every single you know, payment for anything is linked to a charitable donation. So for instance, every time someone signs up and becomes a member with us, we immediately donate 365 days of life-saving clean water to families in Ethiopia. When someone does a 2-month trial with us, we give 2 months of e-learning to children in India. When someone comes to a competition, we give a bike to a child to get to school in Cambodia. And when someone gets a black belt, we build a well for them in Africa. So over the course of this black belt journey, you know, when a child leaves us, we can say, here's a PDF document with your impact over the last 8 years in the world. And it's quite a beautiful thing to, you know, like I talk about planting a seed, right? When you teach a young person that they can and should impact the world for good, I think that's an amazing achievement to be able to do that. And, you know, one of the partnerships we've got is with the Children's Hospice. So we, you know, we've got a giving culture at the heart of our organization. And really, you know, with this particular partnership, we can't train children who are terminally ill. You know, if they're in bed, we can't train them. But we can train the siblings, who are often not forgotten, but they don't get quite as much attention because the parents' attention, their full attention, is on the child who's incredibly sick. So a lot of the things the other sibling is going through, like the three biggest transitions, changing school, adolescent, or bullying, sometimes the parents can't be there for them. So we step in and say, look, we're going to give you a year's scholarship for free to train you up and to mentor you through those difficult transitions that you may or will encounter. And in the UK, 10% of our students are on scholarships. Our goal is to reach 50%. So right now, what we're doing over the next 3 years is we're partnering with orphanages in third world countries around the world, with the hope of having, I think it's, we want 25,000 students on scholarships in the next 3 years. So it's quite a big goal. But that for us, the fact that we've started this process is, and the feedback we've had from some of these parents, really heartwarming feedback, is from a personal point of view, being one of the biggest achievements. But it's one of the things we don't advertise. It's kind of unseen. But yeah.
Wow, well, that sounds pretty amazing in itself. And again, that you're quite good at kind of predicting what I'm going to ask, because one of my next ones was future plans and aspirations. But
all right,
obviously you've given quite a big bold one there. Is there any other big ones in the pipeline?
Yeah, totally. I mean, our kind of moonshot in the Warrior Academy is to have, you know, sort of 50,000 students around the world. 50% of them should be on scholarships. 50% will be paying members. You know, like I mentioned, we're starting up in orphanages mostly. You know, we're in talks right now with an amazing charity in Cambodia, where we're hoping to have 300 students sign up and become Warrior Academy students on scholarships over there, employing local martial artists to become instructors. So also helping, you know, rural villages or rural towns economically as well. So that's one of the things we're doing, with the long-term goal of, you know, if you imagine we've had orphans or children from disadvantaged backgrounds in these different countries around the world going through our 8 to 10 year Warrior Academy program, the Black Belt Journey, and then stepping up into the instructors' roles. And we can then offer international job positions to all of these, you know, orphans around the world. I just think that would be the most amazing goal for us over the next 10 years. Big picture stuff, right? So that's the long-term view of what we're actually trying to do. Short-term view is that we're hoping to open up in, we're in obviously the UK and Dubai right now. We're hoping to open up in Abu Dhabi by the end of the year. And then in 2022 and 23, we're hoping to launch in Qatar, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. So that's our vision.
I was there too late. I was in Kuwait 5 years, and now you're going to go without me. Well, yeah. hopefully Mr. Croshaw can help you, you know, get in the door there.
Maybe.
With his contacts.
That's it. Yeah, that'd be good.
He might, I don't know if he's important enough. We'll have to see. Right. Well, that that kind of concludes my main kind of focus questions. But we've got, we're trying to get a bit of continuity in our podcast. So we've brought in a relatively new quick-ish fire round, we call it, because we know that our guests like to maybe expand on their answers. Obviously, cool. It can be a short one, or it can be rapid fire. So, yeah, let's see if you're ready for these. And so, favorite food.
Pad Thai.
That was easy. All right, okay. Interesting fact.
Interesting fact. Interesting fact.
I think you've given us a few already, but I think you're gonna have to come.
Yeah,
up
right. I've got two dogs. One dog is called Gordon, who's named after a gin festival because we got him immediately after. The other dog's called Bruce because he looks like he's got the Batman symbol on his face, so Bruce Wayne.
Right, that is okay. I'll give you that. Yeah. Favorite holiday destination? Not that you're going anywhere anytime soon, but
yeah, Dubai, I guess. My favorite holiday destination. I say Africa. I think it's just incredible. South Africa.
Okay. Favorite gadget.
Favorite gadget. Probably tracking sleep with a watch like this, you know, or lack of sleep.
Because you sound like a data man, so I think tracking. Yeah,
yeah, right.
Imagine that, yeah. Favorite book apart from your own one, obviously.
Yeah, favorite book. 4-Hour Work Week. I like that. That's a great book. Okay.
Tim Ferriss. Yeah, that's a good book.
Yeah.
Okay.
All of his books are great, though.
Yes, they are. He's a good author. Most famous person met?
Sheikh Mohammed. It's okay. Pretty famous.
Yeah, I'll give you that.
Who else have I met? I don't know. Yeah.
And as you see, I think I'd get stumped if somebody asked me some of these questions. I'd probably miss out on the person that was most famous. If you were an animal, what would you be?
If I was an animal, I think I'd be a monkey, you know? I don't know why, I like monkeys. I once worked as a monkey chaser in India. My job was to, I was working in a hotel in Mumbai. Yeah, you weren't expecting this, were you? This should fall into the interesting facts category. I was working as a monkey chaser because, I was picking up jobs all over India, Southeast Asia, and one of them was... you know, we were sitting down at a cafe, me and a friend of mine, a hotel cafe at the bottom. No one was using the restaurant. And there were branches all over the floor. And we realized there was a monkey problem up there because in the trees they were, you know, getting rid of they were just breaking the branches and stuff. So we said, look, if you let us stay, you know, free accommodation, free food, we'll chase the monkeys around with brooms for a week. And that's basically what happened, you know. So I do like monkeys. They're cheeky. They're pretty intelligent. They're good fun. I'd be a monkey.
is a good story, that one. A free accommodation on the basis you were a monkey chaser. Some people might think you even made that one up, but I'm buying it. I like that one.
It's not a sustainable career path, though.
Maybe not. Because once you chase them away, then you've lost your job, haven't you?
Yeah, right. You've got to do a pretty average job to keep your job.
If you could get yourself anything at all in the world, what would it be?
If I could get myself a ticket to space, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. Adventure, somewhere new, ticket to space.
Okay. And then the last one is, biggest life lesson you could share in under 60 seconds to our listeners.
The biggest life lesson that I could share in under 60 seconds would be to avoid comfort if you feel it weakens you. A lot of people, they seek comfort, and that is the natural path for them. They have a kind of distorted view of risk taking, in that they feel that their imagination of fear, which is basically just an imagination of what could possibly go wrong, is far stronger than the imagination of what could go right. And so they live their life that way. Every decision they make is almost governed by fear or anxiety. But certainly by seeking a life of challenge and trying to become a stronger person by seeking uncomfortability, you'll radically change your life and live a much, much more prosperous, exciting life.
Well, that is a solid way to round up the podcast episode there. Sebastian, I know you're a very busy man, so I appreciate you spending a bit of time with us today to be on the episode. And thanks a lot for being here and being so insightful and sharing so much good stories.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Nattering with the Knights. If you want to make sure that you don't miss any future episodes, then please subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. Please reach out to your PE teacher if you have any feedback or ideas about topics you would like to see and hear about in the future. In the meantime, have a great week, and we will see you next time.